Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell. Thanks for recovering from me last week, guys. It was good to be on vacation.
We missed you. I hope you had fun in San Diego, and I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
As always, thanks to everybody who is listening this Tuesday. Your support helps keep things going because we do not have like a David Ellison to pay us way more than we're worth in order to sell out. Speaking of which, on to controversies and non-troversies. Sharon Waxman, writing in the New York Times, believes one man is to blame for much of the trouble surrounding one of Hollywood's most gloried studios. No, it's not David Ellison. Warner Brothers is where it is because of David Zaslav. And that name has become kind of synonymous with corporate greed and the sort of corporate shenanigans that have left Hollywood vulnerable to takeover. Waxman lays out the basics, writing, quote, "The deal-making protege of the octogenarian cable mastermind, John Malone, Mr. Zaslav was in the right or wrong place at the right or wrong time, depending on how you look at it. Thanks to a series of fortunate for him events, Discovery, his very basic cable TV company, in 2022 ate the larger and more prestigious Warner Media, while in the process loading the whole thing up with $50 billion in debt." End quote. All in all, Zaslav is going to walk away from the company, you know, set aside the money he made putting together this deal in the first place and all the salary that he's collected over the years. He's going to wind up making somewhere between $550 and $900 million that will send Warner Brothers into Paramount Skydance's arms if it goes through, which is not, you know, 100% done deal, but probably will end up going through. In addition, again, to all the other money he's racked up. If you really want to understand how Warner's wound up here, though, you got to look back to the pre-Zaslav era. Like many movie studios, Warner Brothers has been a rotating asset for lots of different companies over the years. It's accumulated many of its own assets in the process. I could spend 25 minutes just running through them all. But the biggest that you should probably know about are in the late 60s, the company that was Warner Brothers bought the company that would become DC Comics. It merged with Time in 1989 to form Time Warner, and then bought the Turner assets, the Turner cable assets, companies like TNT, TCM, TBS, CNN, etc. And then kind of disastrously merged with AOL at the end of that decade. Fast forward a bit, Time Warner was eventually bought by AT&T, of all things, in 2018. Made some sense. You know, Comcast had Universal, AT&T was like, well, what if we had Warner Brothers? Sure, why not? That fit was so bad that Zaslav, then the head of Discovery, was able to convince AT&T to let them take WB off of their hands and larder the joint company up with a bunch of debt. After spending the better part of the 2020s repeatedly rebranding the HBO app, mostly, and successfully, let's be honest, paying down a huge chunk of the debt that they had accrued, Warner's stock was in the toilet. It was like 10 bucks a share or something. And then along comes David Ellison, who wants to buy Warner Brothers to get access to all of its lucrative IP, picked up, for instance, when it bought the company that would become DC, a huge deal that would create another mega company that it itself have like $110 billion, like some insane amount of debt. I am convinced that they're just putting all these companies together and going to put all the debt in one place and then cancel it all out and send the economy into a tailspin. Anyway, this is, again, very truncated version of everything that's happened. Zaslav, what I'm saying, is just a symptom of the broader problem with modern movie making, which is that modern studios are less creatures of their own devices. They're not family, you know, fiefdoms anymore, right? It's not like a guy is out there like, I'm going to make a lot of money by making good movies, right? They're all pawns on a corporate chessboard. Like, again, Universal, which is part of Comcast, or Amazon and Apple Studios, which are offshoots of trillion-dollar tech companies, right? Or they're moonshots looking to become multi-billion-dollar unicorns in their own right. Things like A24 and Neon, which are very much creatures of private equity. As long as you are in this to go public and score huge, you are always going to have folks like Zaslav swimming around. Peter, what happened to making movies for the love of the game?
I love the also, game. I'm not making.
But also, is David Zaslav making movies or is he making corporations? Right? Like, I mean, I am the person on this podcast who's probably like most capitalism skeptical, and I don't really see what David Zaslav is doing as sort of betrayal of the art of movie making. Like, he's just a corporate guy. He's getting like a ridiculous corporate, you know, parachute payment. I mean,
but also movie making, studio movie making anyway, is a corporate endeavor that requires, that is inseparable from huge amounts of money that people are going to treat as, in many cases, at least as, if not much more interesting than the movies themselves. I mean, in fact, one of the things that is interesting about the history of movies is that despite the huge amount of money, people have continued to treat the movies often, not always, not David Zaslav. I think there's a case to be made that he's not that interested in great films, although, in fact, Warner Brothers had a pretty epic run in his final year atop the studio there. Movies have always kind of batted out, like have always had a pull that goes beyond their strict financial value, right? I think I want to say there was a study. Maybe I'm totally making this up, but I want to say there was some study like in the 90s, even in sort of the peak of the kind of modern movie era, where it was like, no one should ever spend a dollar making a movie, right? Like just like as an investor on the whole, you should never make a movie. And yet people made a lot of movies in the 1990s. And some of them, in fact, even made a fair amount of money doing it. Usually not $900 million, although Steven Spielberg did eventually become a billionaire. But this is the thing is this is why we have, for one thing, this segment on this podcast, is because all of us understand that you cannot separate these incredibly expensive products where a cheap movie costs $5 million. I mean, a very cheap movie, right? We're now in the age where hours of television on HBO, owned by Warner Brothers, can cost $100 million. That's the new Harry Potter show, which is insane, by the way. And I still can't wrap my head around the fact that they're reportedly spending that. But there is, when the products cost that much, there's just no way to get big corporations and all of the stuff that comes with big corporations out of the business. And it's going to attract some people who are more corporate minded and more money minded than they are movie minded. And that does have consequences sometimes, and I don't always love them. In this case, though, Sonny, Alyssa, I do want to sort of hear from you here, but like maybe from both of you in some ways, because Sonny, at least, when we initially had a discussion about the sale of Warner Brothers, that was when it was going to Netflix. And I think Alyssa and I said that overall, we preferred Netflix. Alyssa, correct me if I'm wrong about you there. I know that's what I said. And you, Sonny, said you preferred that the company ultimately be sold to Paramount if those were the choices. That's what's happening now. It's going to somebody who loves movie, right? Like Warner Brothers and their assets is going to somebody who loves movies. David Ellison, maybe you don't think much of him as a filmmaker or as a producer, but he clearly just loves the actual product. And like he's got James Cameron out there who made Terminator 2, which is the movie that, sort of blew his mind as a kid. He's got James Cameron out there defending this as like perfectly good and fine. And like Ellison will be a good steward because he's somebody who loves movies and gets them.
Yeah. The short answer is, if push comes to shove in a completely neutral environment, I would probably prefer Paramount to own Warner Brothers to Netflix for a variety of reasons. The problem there are so many things that are not just in a neutral kind of vacuum environment, right? There's all the regulatory stuff. There's all the CNN stuff. There's all the debt stuff. There's all the financing of it, which is going to be, there's so much money from, kind of shady Middle Eastern nations that I don't know that I necessarily feel comfortable.
Hey, that whole region of the world is completely on the up and up. We can just see it every day in the news.
Exactly. So like I it's one of these things where in theory I would prefer David Ellison and Paramount to own Warner Brothers, because I think it's better for movie theaters. I think it is better for filmmaking, at least a certain segment of filmmaking. It is not clear to me David Ellison has a great artistic eye, but he does have a decent eye for some of the business, the big, businessy, blockbustery type stuff. But everything is so now kind of tied up in like, well, Netflix got forced out because they got essentially hamstrung by the government saying, we're not going to approve this. And you can debate how much of that had to play into it, whatever. It clearly was a factor. in all of this. You know, I think that is bad, and we cannot ignore that. Again, the issue here is less. See, I have always thought David Zaslav is a symptom of the problem. As I said in my kind of preamble there, I don't think that David Zaslav is a particularly bad or amoral person. I think he is doing he is following the incentives that have been set up for him. And this is the incentive of Warner Brothers is to package it with larger and larger companies for whatever reason. For whatever reason over the years this has happened, that it would wind up with Paramount is fine, I guess. That it winds up with Paramount that is backed by the government putting a gun to the head of all the shareholders of Netflix is probably bad. So, you know, just it's mixed
very
bag.
Briefly, the reason it keeps getting passed around is because it's difficult to make money making movies. But also, movies have an allure to them that goes beyond the money. And everybody wants
got a studio,
to own
though.
Batman.
But David Ellison already has a studio. Netflix already has a studio. They already have the allure. It's not like they're going to be like, oh, we've got double the allure now. We've got allure to spare.
I do want to just bring us back to the question of whether David Zaslav in particular is bad and whether this pay package is ridiculous. And like this is a funny role for me on the podcast. But if David Zaslav's job is to create value for the shareholders of Warner Brothers, he did that, right? And he did that in a business that is very difficult to do, that involved to try and, I mean, there
how
are,
did he
there
do
are
it?
A lot.
How did he do it? He did it because David Ellison was like, I want to pay you $25 a share for this thing.
Yeah. And that is what you're supposed to do if you are this, like the chief executive of a public company, right? Like you are supposed to get the best deal that you can for your shareholders. You're supposed to maximize profit for them. That is, we don't have to like that. That's the way the economy works, but that's what the job is. And, you know, when you look at, for example, things like the proposed Tesla pay package for Elon Musk that would pay him like $1 trillion, right? I can't even believe that there's going to be like, there might be a trillionaire in the world, right? Like, you know, when the guy isn't even sort of solely focused on the company, like there are crazy sounding pay proposals out there for executives. But by the standards of the narrow remit, did David Ellison create value for the shareholders of the company that he sold? He did it. He got the debt on the company down. And like, I think he is, I just can't be too angry about this one. On the broader situation, the total screwed upness of it, like, absolutely, Sonny is correct. But whether David Zaslav earned his money, kind of think he did.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even really disagree with that. It's one of the reasons, again, why I like have trouble getting particularly worked up about David Zaslav. If it hadn't been David Zaslav, it probably would have been somebody else who did something similar and maybe worse. Who knows? I don't know. Like, it's funny because I think a lot of the things that we were all kind of aghast at the time, for instance, merging HBO and Discovery, have kind of worked. Like HBO Max, say what you will about HBO Max, it still is HBO, and mm-hmm. I just don't watch the Discovery stuff. And like, yep. it has grown greatly. It is much bigger now. It has more subscribers. It seems to have been functionally a success at doing what it wanted to do, which is to kind of compete with Netflix, but again, not enough of a success to stand on its own. The real problem is all of this is tied up with some of the other purchases that Warner Brothers had made, for instance, buying the cable companies, which throw off a lot of revenue, but are in steady decline and blah, blah, blah. I mean, I don't know. Outro with that, but it is what it is.
David Zaslav, not the villain.
Yeah. Peter, any more?
Warner Brothers made some great movies. Warner Brothers is being transferred to the owner that you prefer, Sonny. I actually still, the more, like, I'm not opposed to David Ellison, but I actually, the more I think about this deal, think it would have been better for the movies for Warner Brothers to go to Netflix. And that also would have dealt with a bunch of the debt issues and a bunch of other stuff there. But this is, you know, it's being transferred to somebody who does in fact love movies. And also this is, maybe it's not great. Maybe you just sort of find this kind of transaction and this way of running an artistic business to be ugly and unpleasant. But David Zaslav didn't invent that. This is not new. Warner Brothers in particular has just been passed off from hand to hand, from company to company, from corporation and corporate guy to corporation and corporate guy for decades.
Yeah. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that David Zaslav exists? Alyssa?
Non-controversy.
Peter?
The whole thing is a little bit controversial, but the David Zaslav, all of it. The only thing that's a little bit controversial about him is not the pay package he's getting for this deal, but he was, in my view, like relative to other studio heads and the job he was doing, somewhat overpaid during his years, like just like the kind of annual compensation. He was being paid maybe a little more than what the Netflix or around what the Netflix guys something were in there. He's like $50 million a year, something like that. I may have my numbers slightly off
something
here.
Something like that.
Please fact. It was unusual relative to what Warner Brothers was doing. Like when you looked at like, oh, Netflix is like just a much better business. There wasn't that giant, that big a gap.
Yeah. The existence of a David Zaslav type is controversial. The existence of David Zaslav himself is only controversial in the sense that he inserted himself into the Wizard of Oz at the fucking Sphere. So, you know, that's a controversy. All
hey, right. Martin Scorsese put himself in Taxi Driver.
Well, yeah, but he also made the movie. David Zaslav didn't make The Wizard of Oz. He's not Victor Fleming. Anyway, make sure to swing by movieisle.substack.com on Thursday for a special bonus episode about the absurdity of the art world. Speaking of which, on to the main event, The Christophers. As longtime listeners of this show know, we are Steven Soderbergh completists. So when there's a new Soderbergh, we are on it. The Christophers is, well, not quite wide yet. Wide-ish. It's on 364 screens. So if you live in a city, if you live in a proper city or even probably a large suburb, it's probably playing somewhere near you. You know, drive and go see it or wait for it to come out on VOD. You can watch it then and then come back and listen to this episode. But there will be discussion of the things that happen in the movie. So if you have not seen it and you were worried about that sort of thing, please don't yell at me. Just stop listening. Written by Ed Solomon, who worked with Steven Soderbergh on both No Sudden Move and Full Circle, which we have, both of which we have covered on this show. The Christophers is part heist movie, part rumination on the nature of art and artistry, part buddy comedy. In the opening moments, we see Laurie Butler, who's played by Michaela Cole, propositioned by Barnaby and Sally, who are played respectively by James Corden and Jesse Gunning. BNS want Laurie to pose as an assistant for their father in the hopes of stealing some of his unfinished masterpieces, the titular Christophers, who are portraits of Julian's, who's played by Ian McKellen, boyfriend, one of his boyfriends. Anyway, I'm sorry. She, being a skilled artist in her own right and a bit of a forger, will then finish them. And then when Julian dies, the siblings who have been cut out of the will sell them for millions to unsuspecting dupes. It's a very straightforward plan. Most of the film is a two-hander between McKellen and Cole. He kicks things off by functionally monologuing at her about her own stature in the world before returning to his sad life of making cameos for folks who remember him mostly as a reality show star for the horrendous art fight in which he insults random people who dared showed up with paintings to be judged. Things get more interesting once Julian says the Christophers are to be destroyed, and more interesting still once he learns that she is no fan of him, having celebrated his cancellation for, which is kind of interesting here. Solomon and Soderbergh never get into it. We don't know what he did to get himself canceled. I find this omission kind of interesting for what it says about the purpose of this film, which is not to fight about that sort of thing, but to address the broader questions. Anyway, The Christophers is many things. It's a rumination on family and mentorship. It's comedy about a bitchy old man who's trying to find footing in a world that's changing around him. But mostly it's a movie about authenticity in art and the business surrounding it. There are lots of funny little asides, particularly surrounding the children's efforts to secure the art and what will ultimately be done with it. Spoiler, donating it to a shitty museum for a tax write-off by a tech bro out in California. The Museum of the Southwest or Museum of the Desert. Museum of the Desert is the name of it. Just terrible. In Las Vegas. I mean, you couldn't be more gauche. Laurie hopes to convince Julian to reconnect with what drove him in the first place to create art. And in so doing, she will help him atone for his sins, including an ugly one committed against her some years in the past. The Christophers is shot simply yet elegantly. Soderbergh kind of moves us through the emotional beats via his camera work. We are locked down and steady at the beginning of the film when we're outside. And then once Laurie steps inside Julian's townhome in London, we move to kind of a shakier handheld style, suggesting unevenness, unsteadiness. She is entering his world and is at first off balance, though that lessens as the film proceeds. As the film goes on, it's more, you know, kind of steady and locked down again as she asserts her own sense of self. Really, though, this is a movie of performances. This is a movie you watch for the acting. And both McKellen and Cole are delightfully nuanced in it. They seem to be having quite a lot of fun playing off of each other. Just this kind of mix of, again, like guarded bitchiness and empathetic concern. I like this movie a lot, though I cannot offer a proper review as I interviewed Ed Solomon on my other podcast. So I will not be giving a thumbs up or thumbs down to this movie. I enjoyed a great deal. Alyssa, did you like The Christophers?
Oh my God, I loved this movie. Steven Soderbergh is on such a run right now, just in terms of providing cinematic pleasure to audiences, right? Like between this and Black Bag, these are two of the best times that I've had at a movie in the last sort of 16, 18 months. And there are so many things that I like about it, but I just want to start with faces, because this is a movie about the actual depiction of someone's face, the sort of pseudonymous Christopher. And, you know, they have cast for this movie people with just unbelievably fabulous, distinctive faces who know how to use them expressively, right? I mean, Mikaela Cole and Ian McKellen have very different kinds of faces, right? He is older, his face is softer, he's got blue eyes. She is all sort of sharp angles, really high cheekbones. You know, she's black, he's white. And so they're steady in contrast, but they are people who are just divine to look at because they are so, you know, I mean, we're in the middle of this absurd sort of looks maxing phenomenon where everyone, like a bunch of idiot guys on the internet, are all trying to make themselves look like Matt Bomer, and women are giving themselves Mar-a-Lago face. And just the pleasure of spending 2 hours looking at two totally distinct faces is, I think, really not to be underestimated in this moment. These are two people who look entirely like themselves and no one else. They're both just completely gorgeous in their own ways. But then, my God, what they do with those faces, right? I mean, just watching Laurie during that opening monologue by Julian, where she is alternately scared because she's gone to his house to commit a kind of sustained fraud. She's baffled. Julian has this incredible sort of bizarre joke of telling people to go in so he actually owns not one but two townhouses, and he keeps telling visitors to go in the door other than the one where they rang the bell. You know, she's off balance. The house is kind of
because
a mess.
There are two parts to him. There's the surly mean part and the yeah.
And so just watching, I mean, it's not just that McKellen delivers this unbelievable monologue, but you just have the joy of watching her react for like several minutes where she cannot get a word in edgewise, right? Where he is delivering this incredibly sort of all over the place monologue that ends with him asking how she is with humidifiers, right? And so, you know, these few actors have faces that are a pleasure to watch them when they're still. They're a pleasure to watch when they're in motion. It's a pleasure to watch them talk. And it is really hard for me to think about sort of who else could have been cast in these roles in a movie that's just about a face that you can't stop looking at and thinking about, right? So that's just delightful. The script is a hoot. Oh my God, right? I mean, Julian has initially told Laurie that these 9 paintings are to be shredded. And he confronts her one day. He's like, I've decided they're not to be shredded. And there's this pause. You think he's going to say maybe that they're to be preserved. They're to be burned, right? It just drags her out into the backyard, goes in search of turpentine. But I think, you know, it's also a movie about genuine artistic inspiration and whether or not you can force it. I think the movie's answer is clearly that you cannot. it's a movie about technique, right? One of my favorite scenes in the movie is when Laurie analyzes the Christophers and has this obvious technical mastery of the craft that they both share and uses it to deliver just an incredibly psychologically incisive reading of what Julian intended in the pictures and why he wasn't able to finish them. And, you know, it's about the business of art, right? And it's, you know, I think that in the movie is interesting on this question in the sense that it clearly deplores certain kinds of crassness, right? Like the idea of, you know, donating these paintings for a tax write-off is sort of obviously presented as abhorrent. And the casting of Corden and Gunning in these roles is like meant to make their motivations ridiculous, right? Like they are comedians. They are sort of broader, less distinctive faces. They are just physically less attractive than our two protagonists. You know, the movie is also very skeptical of turning art into a sort of a cheap reality competition. But I wouldn't say that it is a movie that is against the idea that art has value, maybe even considerable value, right? It's just, you know, I mean, in fact, the sort of reconciliation point in the movie comes where, and heavy spoiler part, you know, heavy spoiler warning here. Laurie does end up faking the Christophers, but gives them to the young man who was depicted in them, who ends up, you know, in like making them available as part of this retrospective. And, you know, Laurie has ended up making meaningful, interesting work with the cameo videos that Julian recorded. And so there is this, you know, there is this sort of uneasy conclusion about sort of how, you know, yes, art should have value. How do we determine it? You know, when is something commerce versus when is it art? But, you know, as with some other movies we've discussed recently, it has the sophistication not to tell you exactly what it means. And to just sort of let you sit there with it a little bit and to appreciate the work on your own. There is just a fundamental tension in that one of the points Julian makes at some point in the movie is that he says he's not able to fully judge Laurie's work just by seeing it through a screen. He has to see it in person. And I think the movie, you know, therefore kind of makes the argument that we cannot entirely judge the art that we're seeing in the movie. But I think in its focus on process, on technical mastery, and on genuine inspiration, it encourages us to believe that art has value. And almost to sort of nudge you out into the world and say, go look at some things for yourself.
Well, the initial time that that line about how you can't judge anything through a screen is rolled out, I mean, I think you may have noticed, I like nearly hooted when that line gets deployed, right? And McKellen is coming up the stairs into his studio. It's almost a throwaway, like the camera sort of catches it off guard. It's kind of turning to him as he's pulling in, you know, pulling around the corner, coming up the stairs, right? It's just this little tiny offhanded remark that of course bears huge weight, even if there's no payoff for it, right? It's because you are of course watching all of this happen through a screen yourself. And so the movie is telling you something about the thing that you are watching. But then what happens later is it's not that he says he can't judge it through his, he's not sure if he can judge it through a screen. He does. He tells her that her painting is dog shit. There, I mean, maybe a different word, but like he tells her that it's awful. And then there's this great moment even later after that when he goes to her studio and sees it in person. And it is something new. And this is, I mean, in fact, a more extreme version of an experience that I've had with works of art where I've been totally unmoved by seeing. I mean, not like I thought they were awful, but totally unmoved by them, or just sort of like, oh, that's kind of interesting when I see them on, you know, printed on a page in an art book, and then you see them in a museum. And I wouldn't say it happens that often with a painting, but certainly, like, you know, with the Vermeer's windows that I have seen a few of, like, just kind of left me speechless when I saw them in person. And they're smaller than you think they're going to be, but they just come across as these incredibly cinematic, almost photographic moments of a time that you couldn't take a photo of, that you can't access visually any other way, right? And so, but he has not that experience, but he has this sort of revelatory experience of seeing the physical thing truly in front of him. And part of what we're meant to wonder there is he really seeing it new? Yes, I think he is. But or is it really that he has gotten to know the person? And now that he understands the person, does that change his perception of the art along with seeing it in the flesh?
I think also is he really bothering to look, right? Because as it turns out, Julian has been in a room with this painting before. And, you know, yes. when Laurie was on Art Fight and he confesses to her that he did not really look at her work, right? He was just trying to come up with the next joke, yes. the next insult. And so he didn't really look at what she produced.
Though that not really looking is, again, it raises the question of, was he not really looking at the art or was he not really looking at her? Because as he says, he's just sort of teeing up the next insult joke in his head. And in fact, when that scene is replayed for us in the third act, right, we kind of get this as a flashback. We see a figure who is clearly her, but she at a younger her, but she is always out of focus. The movie in that scene never lets us see her face, her figure. I suspect it is a different actress, but I can't say for certain in that scene. And so he's not looking. It's not just the art that he's not looking at. It's her.
As is he, though, importantly, in that sequence. So like the way this scene is shot, it's basically over the shoulder of you have Laurie and you have Julian, and they're kind of she's standing, he's sitting. The shot begins, I believe, from over her shoulder to him. She is in focus. The back of her head is in focus, but his face is out of focus. And then it's the reverse shot, which is the same thing. The back of his head is in focus, yeah. and her face and her artwork are out of focus. And I think the point here is fairly obvious, which is that they see themselves and how they think of themselves, but the other person does not see how. And it's interesting. So I want to.
But that's what the movie is about: is the two of them learning to see each other, and they also in the process learn to see each other's art.
Sure. This is. I think Steven Soderbergh has made several films here in this run where you could describe them as movies about making movies, but not strictly speaking about making. They're not. You know, it's not Babylon. Right. But it is, it is kind of in that vein of an artist grappling with the work that they've done and the work that they would like to do and how that work is seen. High Flying Bird is probably the other most, kind of specific one about the tension of, art and commerce and all that. But is this a movie about movies? Is this a movie about filmmaking, or is that just the solipsism of the critic who sits here and sees, the description? Alyssa, you're right to highlight that scene about the brushstrokes, because it is like kind of the moment where everything crystallizes, and also it's the moment where I think Solomon and Soderbergh are both saying a lot of the discussion about what we do is facile, and you have to be an artist to really be able to critique it.
It's the big turn that is almost exactly like within 2 or 3 minutes and maybe within 45 seconds of the midpoint of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, yes, to a certain extent, this is about movie making in the sense that it's about sort of art in general. I do think it is sort of specifically about painting in a way without which the movie would be less good. Right. I mean, it is about sort of the specifics of technique. It is about the solitariness of painting. It is about sort of the iteration that comes with revisiting one subject over and over again, as many painters have done. It's also very much about the sort of the tactile nature of painting. Right. I mean, there's this very interesting scene where Julian starts to play with one of the Christophers. He's like trying to deface it. And finds he just can't do it. He's like, he says, I just can't make it look bad, right? And it's, but part of what's so interesting about that scene is that his fingers and hands are covered with this sort of thick pink paint and feathers and glitter. And it's also just very interesting that we never see one of the original Christophers in the first two sets, right? I find that kind of a fascinating choice by the movie. But yeah, I do think it is specifically about painting in a way that makes it much more interesting than it would be if it was just a metaphor for making movies.
Fair. That is fair. I don't know. What else?
It's a truly exceptional script. And also, this is a film that makes the case for Soderbergh being maybe the single best director of actors of the last 40 years.
He's crazy.
It is
good.
Definitely. Yeah, this is definitely a performance film. This is a movie you go to watch the performances in, which is not always the case. That's not, it's not a sure thing.
But his direction of actors has been so good for so long. I won't say he discovered George Clooney, because George Clooney was already a big star on television, but he discovered how George Clooney could be a movie star. He's the only director to ever get an actually exceptional, not just perfectly tolerable, performance out of Jennifer Lopez. He, built... Out of Sight is a great performance by her, and she has never given a great performance except in that movie. And that is directorial skill. And this is somebody who also consistently likes to work with actors who are non-actors, right? You see that even in some of his sort of weirdest experiments like Bubble, but he brings people in who don't have traditional acting experience, and he frequently gets, maybe not in all cases, really exceptional performances, really interesting performances, and draws people out of themselves. And when you get two really good actors who are on his wavelength, it's just something to behold.
For sure. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on the Christopher's, Alyssa?
I'll give it 2 thumbs up to make up for the one that you can't actually give it.
Peter.
Huge thumbs up. It's Soderbergh's best in a long time, and I hope Solomon gets a nomination for the screenplay.
As I said, I cannot possibly review this. That would be a violation of principles. So I shan't. All right. That is it for this week's or this Tuesday's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sunday Munch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Thursday, hopefully.